looked at this Bronze Age Neolithic layout, and looking at this this work really, which is about the working with ancestral consciousness, working with the deep life of the land. I'm going to just develop it and move forward with it a bit. But one of the interesting things really about the Geoffrey of Monmouth's writings, right, they're both the History of the Kings of Britain and the Vita Merlini, the Life of Merlin, are written in the 12th century. And therefore they are the oldest written manuscripts we possess. We know nothing earlier than that. Mabinogion, the Black Book of Cymmal, then is regarded as the earliest written Welsh manuscript. It's mid-13th century. And again, this is the same process of just recognizing, partly because of the way, in a way it's interesting, I suppose, what's happened in the 20th century. The recovery of these ancient methods, ancient approaches, has led to a degree of confabulation over assumption of knowing things that we don't know. One example of this would be people write courses or write books about the Welsh gods that are found in the Mabinogi. No god or goddess is described in the Mabinogi. There are powerful images, powerful beings, but they were never a god or a goddess. There is no evidence at all of that. Any more than there is any evidence at all for druids. There is, but there isn't at the same time. So, how do we know about druids? Well, there are a number of reasons how we know about druids. One of which is the resurgence of Welsh nationalism and the desire to find a different kind of spirituality from the Orthodox. But which leads to things in Wales, leads to the development of cultural Welsh nationalism, leads to the creation of the National Eisteddfod. It leads, happily, unfortunately, into the resurgence of the Welsh language. So our language is not lost. It also leads to the reviving or the rediscovery of old stories. And all these things are important, but they've become overshadowed by a particularly modern sensibility of thinking, of imagining. And one of the particular problems we have, is when we look at anything, we look at it from our own viewpoint and from the viewpoint of our own culture. So when people are looking at things like the Mabinogi stories or the poems in the Black Book of Carmarthen, they attribute to them the wish to find something that is an ancient religion that will suit us better than the religion that we have been bequeathed. Means that we start to interpret those old stories and ideas in the way, in a wish fulfillment way, in a way we would like it to be. So here are the gods and the goddesses we can worship. Here are the practices and the prayers that we can employ. And I love Glastonbury, I love living here, but there is a a whole 14-year pagan practice that it's beautiful, it's harmless. We have, you know, one of the things that in my life that I have seen happen is this idea of the festivals of the year, the eight festivals of the year, which have become institutionalized. This is what the ancients did, and it's a total fabrication. In the older traditions, only the tradition that I'm used to in terms of working with the inner is working with the inner tides, which means working with the equinoxes and the solstices, and that's a private inner practice and related very much to locality and relating to what are the energies of life doing. What the eight? I have nothing against the eight festivals, except that they are a fabrication. Right? They come really out of the development of Gardnerian Wicca in particular, and picking up on various folklore festivals in Britain. And as I say, it's harmless. There's nothing wrong with them, but not a lot right with them either, from an inner point of view. They're nice, they're enjoyable, but they're not founded in anything other than the wish to have a nice, enjoyable time.
Excuse me, change it slightly, in that the four cross-border festivals are legitimate agricultural festivals in Ireland.
In Ireland.
And the solar festivals, as ideas for spiritual practice, are more problematic, but the four agricultural festivals, it would be difficult, I think, to have an ancient agricultural festival without that sort of a spiritual connection to whatever is going on in the land.
Where do you know the connection from, Ben?
Sorry, the connection.
So when you're saying there is a spiritual connection to these, to the festivals, what are you drawing on? You
say that. Drawing on is what we understand about the origins of ancient religion being in the friction between man and his sustenance on the earth, and the need to make a relationship in some way between the way we live off the earth and the gifts we get from it. And I don't know what the most ancient practices are.
The trouble is, most of these practices come from Christianity. That they don't exist beyond that. When you're talking about, if you think of Ploughman Day, the kind of fruits of the harvest, they're Christian festivals.
Yeah, I think we can go to different tribal practices globally that haven't been touched by Christianity to see how they did it, to get an idea of how our ancient ancestors might have done. I take the point that the modern festival is all Christian.
I think there's a certain agricultural element to, like Penny says, you know, like Imbolc is the lactation of the ewes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and, well, you know, Lammas and Lunasa is the harvest, and the slaughtering of the animals at Samhain. And
I think this is similar, but I think that these are very local, right? Mm-hmm. So they've done different time. There isn't the problem I have with this, right? So of course every part of the world has an agricultural system. Therefore, they're dealing with crops and animals and creating, you know. So the Samhain time of year, you're killing the animals, you're gathering in the fruits of the earth because you've got a winter where nothing's going to grow in some parts of the earth. In other parts, it's different. So the actual customs are really kind of different in different localities.
Whereas we make them generic and standardized.
Well, that's kind of what happened, right? And I think, certainly, they've sort of lost their inner correlate. Right, because the thing about the solstices and the equinoxes is these are universal principles, really, that are around that are not to do with local kind of custom, and certainly in the kind of inner tradition as I received it, these are times when you're working with changeovers of energy. So the equinoxes are tipping points. You know, the solstices are high points of light and darkness, and sort of and there are energetic tides moving between those. And of course there are customs. So in the middle, so where the eight come from, in the middle of the four universals, there are these points around the agricultural year, which then gets conflated as though they're part of the energistic system of the four tides. Okay, and in a certain sense and that's what then creates the eight festivals that then becomes, this is a thing that people believe and practice. And you get absurd things have happened, like the autumn equinox gets called Mabon because somebody wrote a book and everybody now thinks it's called Mabon. It's nonsense. But again, it's the same principle here somewhere of having to look underneath and to deconstruct some of these forms. Because if we're going to look at, okay, what is the collective psyche doing underneath? What are the roots of this? Now, for sure, one of the roots are the equinoxes and the solstices. These are ancient patterns that people have always worked with and create this image of the Celtic cross, the circled cross, that is one of the key images, key patterns of the ancient tradition somewhere. And in a certain sense, part of what we're doing really is trying to excavate, trying to look underneath to see, well, what are the deep patterns? Because what's underneath are simple patterns, but deep patterns that represent a relationship between outer and inner life. Now, one of the patterns that comes out of the Kabbalah is the Tree of Life. Another pattern is the circled cross, where we have the four elements and the center point. Now, so there's a certain necessity of stripping away of some of the stuff that's been put on top of this to get to understand, but what's underneath this? What works for us now, what doesn't work? Now, when we look, if I come back to looking at the sense of Britain as the island of the Druids, and we look at, well, what do we know about the Druids? Well, mostly we know what the Romans have told us. So the first person who really speaks about Druids is Caesar in his De Bella Gallico, in his Gallic treatise on the Gallic Wars. Now he's writing to the Senate at Rome because he wants a legion, or hopefully several legions, to invade Britain, so because he thinks it would be very good for him if he can do that. And so he gives us the image, and he's the first person who gives us the real image of what a Druid is. A Druid is a wise man who is a judge, who is exempt from taxes, is a figure who creates peace, who is like the ideal Romano-Greco philosopher. So one of the things he's doing when he describes this is to say, well, here is this, you know, here's this admirable civilization that we could do with conquering, and because there'll be all kinds of goodies there for us, and maybe interesting learning. But what he also says about the Druids is they are these barbarous people who spend most of their time burning people and killing people and sacrificing people. Now, the Romans in their day were very keen on the old sacrifice, but still quite happy to do it in the Colosseum. But actually, the sacrifice of human beings had fallen out of favor in Roman society. So here are these primitives, barbarians. They're all, everybody who's non-Roman is seen as a barbarian. And these barbarians have these admirable people, but who also these horrible cannibalistic killers of human beings. Now that rouses up a sense of disgust in your average Roman, and a desire, well, we should conquer them to civilize them. We should make them civis Romanus, citizens of Rome. Because part of the fantasy of the whole Roman expansion is that, rather like the British Empire actually, that much later on, is that we're conquering the world to help the world, rather than we're ripping you off and stealing all your goods. Well, no, we are civilizing you, we're extending to you the boon of becoming a citizen of Rome. So that's one of the key places where we start to get the idea of a druid. Another place, I'll just find it, I'll read it out. Yes, I will just look it up just a moment. It's about 50 BC. Yeah, 50 BC, that's when. Okay. So then the next, this is him saying, look, come on, let me invade Britain, thanks very much, and dum-de-dum. Next figure we have about 100 years later. Oh, actually, no, that's not true. Sorry, beg your pardon. There was another figure, I'd forgotten about him. 36 BC, so a little bit later, 20 odd years later, is we have Diodorus of Sicily. And Diodorus Siculus talks about the existence among the Gauls of poets and singers called a Bardus, who composed praises and satires. In the same society were deeply respected philosophers and theologians called Druidas, and also there were renowned soothsayers who foretold the future by watching the flight of birds and examining the entrails of victims. The most important divinations were made by stabbing a man fatally in the chest and observing his death throes to see the pattern of his limb and blood flows. The order of stress, no sacrifice was performed without the assistance of a philosopher, meeting the druid, because these men were especially practiced in dealing with deities and seeking their blessings. They were held in such respect they were in armies that when armies were about to join in battle, they would halt immediately if a druid came between the opposed ranks to stop the conflict. This proved, the order says, even the most savage barbarians, and with savage barbarian anger yields to wisdom. He also added the Gauls were accustomed to execute criminals by impaling them in groups and burning them to death. He commented these were customs or examples of their savage ways and their outlandish impiety. Next person we get is Strabo, 20 CE, so about 50 years later. Now Strabo lived all his life in Asia Minor, came as far west as Italy, so not terribly far into Gaul or anywhere near Britain. But he declares that among all the Gallic peoples, three kinds of men were held in exceptional honour. The bardoi, who are singers and poets, the ovetes, who are diviners and experts in the natural world, and the druidi, who studied moral philosophy as well as the workings of nature. The bardoi very clearly the same as the bardos of Diodorus. And his word ovetius is the Latin word vates, which means being a soothsayer. So he's again saying, you know, again saying something similar, but you might notice he's not come anywhere near Britain.
Diodorus.
No, Diodorus did. It's Strabo. Strabo hadn't. Diodorus, well, we don't know really.
Seems a bit iffy.
Yep, that's true. We're not sure. We're not even sure whether. But this is the story, right? This, you can see how this is kind of developing. If you're really interested in the detail of this, Roland Hutton wrote a wonderful book called Blood and Mistletoe, where he's put all of this together. So I'm referring to this just to keep my head in the right kind of gear. So where do we know? Oh, that's right. The third and the last of these early authors we get is a figure with a wonderful name of Pomponius Mela, Spaniard by origin, who's based in Rome. He added that these were writing 40 CE, so again a little bit later. And he says that Roman law has reduced human sacrifice to being a furtive practice among the Gauls. But he said that the Druidists could still be respected as teachers of wisdom, claiming to know the size and the shape of the world, the movements of the heavens, and the will of the deities. They apparently met in secret either in caves or remote valleys, and educated young Gallic nobles in courses lasting up to 20 years. Only one of their teachings is widely known, that souls are eternal and there is another life in the world below. And this was put up by Wylie because it made the Gauls in general brave in battle. And so the next thing, but what he also one of the things he does is talk about the fact that the Gauls are so much believed in future lives that you would lend somebody money in this life and promise to repay it in the next life. So that's a saying you often get around Druidism, and that's where it comes from. Pomponius Mela. But he also says something quite interesting. He talks about an island of priestesses that lived between Britain and Gaul that had 9 women vowed to perpetual virginity and serving as an oracle. The Gauls called them the Senai and believed they could raise a storm with their songs, change themselves into animals, cure any diseases, and predict the future. So this is the first ever reference to what later becomes known as the 9 people of the 9 virgins of Babylon. It's the first ever reference to Babylon, really.
What island is that then?
Well,
like Jersey.
But you <don't. laughs> a mysterious island, Holly, which we know not of. Really, but he did. Now, there's one of the complicated things about this is that there was a figure, a Greek guy called Posidonius, who travelled around the Mediterranean, who travelled around the whole world, who wrote very unreliable stories about how the world was. And much of his texts are lost. And one of the texts that's lost is supposedly Posidonius' story of Britain and Gaul. And one of the possibilities is that the various authors that we're looking at now, not Caesar, but the others, are all referring back to the writings of Posidonius, now lost. But of course, because lost, we don't know if they are referring to that or not. So again, you start to see the complication of this territory, right? How this, all those stories, which sound very compelling and sound like they could be right, could be referring to a lost original, which could in itself be wrong and made up by Posidonius.
Is there any possible, like, correlation between the dates with maybe some sort of like pre-Christian rumor mill that was going on that then became the story of Jesus?
Well, these dates, what do you mean these dates? So we're talking
dates that like Caesar and.
Well, Herod. It's in the same time period, right?
That's what I mean.
So it's in the same time period that the whole Christian mythos is getting redeveloped and changed, and it's immediately. You know, it's in that period immediately. So if we think of 30 BCE, this is more or less the time of Christ's birth. Mm-hmm. And if we look at, you know, and that's not right, I'm talking nonsense. Christ's birth is the very, sorry. No, it's the period, Christ's birth is of course of CE, and certainly the 30 odd years after that is Christ's life, and certainly in the period 50-100 years later than that, that's when the Christian mythos is happening. So it's happening at the same time. Doubt is connected because these are different. These are people. You know, they're just looking in different directions. For one thing, I mean, this is the particular writers here are not at this stage. Later on, the two myths get mingled up, but at this stage, they're looking at Britain just as Britain, and they're looking at it from the point of view of the Roman Empire, and looking at the possibilities of conquest, really.
Get that, but I'm just sort of puzzling over this idea of human sacrifice going out of fashion and then the ultimate human sacrifice.
Yeah, no, that's not connected because that's just really what happened to Roman religion. Mm-hmm. Right, so plenty of animal sacrifice still happening in Roman religion. But this human sacrifice was never a very big part of it. What they used to do is they used to kill, if they wanted to kill people, they put them into the arena, really, and so there isn't a very direct correlation between those two things. So when we continue, let's just continue a little, right? So we've got this idea of the Posidonius, so that also brings in this whole sense of confusion. But one of the interesting things is that Caesar's description of the Druids and the intertribal Druidic organization reads completely different from these other authors. Now Caesar, in this case, is likely to be more reliable, right? Because what you get with these other authors is this sense of people building on each other, and even the similarities between their writings. Now, which is complicated for us, because these other writings are the ones which describe the bard, the druid, the ovate, and they're the more dodgy. Caesar's much less, he doesn't describe it in that kind of detail, but he's much more, as we could say, factual. He's describing something that when you read it feels like, okay, this is what he's reading. He's reading, it's politically slanted. You can see it's politically slanted.
So how did Caesar get this information?
Because he's over there. He's in Gaul. There's also expeditions into Britain. So he's on the spot in a sense, in a way that some of these other figures aren't.
You sort of trust him because he doesn't like him.
No, that's right, totally. And also you can see he's got a real political dimension in his writing, but you can see what he's up to. Right, so he's particularly, you know, he's kind of really wanting to get a legion, because he would like to invade, thanks very much.
He's the one that says they can stop battles.
No, that wasn't him, no. He says that, I mean, he does say that because what you start to see happen, right, is some of the, out of the writers that we've just been describing, you start to see other writers building on this in some ways. Example, Lucanus, Marcus Annaeus Lucanus, not commonly known as Lucan, gives us this very kind of, I've got a literal account of that somewhere here, gives us great account of a horror version of a druidic grove. I'll just find it. Because he's wanting to scare the folks back home and write something that people will be interested in. Where are you looking? Oh yeah, that's right. So Lucan, in his Pharsalia, describes the grove like this. No bird nested in the grove, nor did any animal lurk nearby. The leaves constantly shivered, though no breeze stirred. Altars stood in its midst, and the images of the gods. Every tree was stained with sacrificial blood. The very earth groaned, dead yews revived, and consumed trees were surrounded with flame, and huge serpents twined around the oaks. The people feared to approach the grove, and even the priest wouldn't walk there in midday or midnight, lest he should meet the divine guardian. So, you know, he's developing this kind of theme of these numinous, frightening, terrible. It's a good horror story. People are going to kind of enjoy it, and in a way, you know, And partly he's doing that because Caesar cuts down a grove of Druidic grove near Marseille, and partly he's supporting Caesar by saying, Caesar, look how what a great leader he is. He's destroyed this terrifying numinous kind of place, and this is a man you should trust to, you know, take Britain for you. Now another figure we get is Tacitus. So again, this is later on. This is a 60 C, where Suetonius Paulinus leads an army to North Wales, to Anglesey, and there's a great description of the encounter between the Roman legions and the Druids. On the opposing shores stood the enemy host, with a dense array of armed men, among whom dashed women in black attire like furies, with hair dishevelled, waving flaming torches. All around were Druidi, raising their hands to the sky and shouting dreadful curses which terrified our soldiers, who had never seen such a thing before. So that as if paralyzed, they stood still and exposed their bodies to wounds. Then, swayed by their general's appeal and their own mutual incitements not to be scared by a bunch of frenzied women, they carried the standards forward, hacked down all resistance, and burned the enemies with their own torches. An occupying force was imposed on the conquered, and their groves dedicated to inhuman superstitions were destroyed. They had believed it indeed a duty to drench their altars in the blood of prisoners and to consult their deities through human entrails. Now, one of the interesting things one of them makes a point of view, really, is that Tacitus never stated explicitly that Anglesey was an important place to the Druids, although the text would call you to infer that. And that mainly his reason for attacking Anglesey was it was a densely populated place, and therefore there'd be lots of loot and lots of possibility there.
It's also the breadbasket of Wales, wasn't it?
Yeah, so rich. So a lot of goodness in terms of taking it apart. Yeah.
Nothing written by the Druids.
Nothing. Well, there's all kinds of questions. Well, you see, that's what they say, but who says? And that's the interesting question, you see. So then if we go a little bit later, then the next writer we get really is Pliny. And Pliny writes about the Druids it's from Pliny that we get the idea that the sacred tree of the Druids is the oak. And the most sacred plant is the mistletoe, and it's from, so it's, you know, I mean, what he says is that mistletoe grows very rarely on the oak, which is true, and when it was found there, the Gallic Druidi gathered it according to a political rite. This was, if possible, this was held on the sixth day after a new moon. And they called the mistletoe by a term called the All Healing. They made preparations for sacrifice and a banquet beneath the tree. They led hither two white bulls and prayed to the moon as the healer of all things. Clad in a white robe, the officiating priest, the Sacerdotus, climbed the oak, cut the mistletoe with a golden sickle so that it fell into a white cloak, head ready for it. The victims, presumably but not necessarily the bulls, were then killed with a prayer to the relevant god that the plant would be as effective as possible. They believed that administered in a drink, it made barren animals fertile, proof against poisons. Pliny ends his account with a sneer. Such are the religious feelings held by many people towards trivial things. At another point, he said the Druids believed that the Selago plant warded off all kinds of evil. Its smoke cured diseases of the eyes. He described a rite needed to cut it by a man clad in white with bare feet and divested of iron, but didn't specifically say that that should be Druidic. Pliny also provides a spicy anecdote about native British religious customs, which was to have a great impact on the imagination of modern writers, says Ronald Hutton. There are certain sacred rites. The wives and daughter-in-laws of the Britons march along naked, having stained the whole of their bodies almost black with the dye of the woad plant. This was provided as yet another example of the folly of remote tribes. So, that's all we know, folks.
Where did the Wicker Man idea come from, burning sacrifice in the Wicker Man?
Well, that comes later on. They talk about them burning sacrifices, and somewhere later on that becomes a Wicker Man. That's a much later idea. So basically, what we know, if we come back to what do we know? Mm-hmm.
Nothing.
Not much.
No. These are the stories. So the most reliable figure in this is Caesar. And so what Caesar tells us is there are a class of people who are regarded as wise, who are connected somewhere to the spiritual life of the land and the people, and that are held in honour. But not a lot more than that. I mean, Caesar was a very practical kind of guy. He saw them as central, he saw them as intertribal. And so these are people that, and coming back to some of the thinking around the interconnected earlier civilization of Britain, where we get the Stonehenge thing. So this idea of a civilization that is profoundly connected and has therefore a strong intertribal structure as well as a tribal structure. Now that matches what we're now starting to discover. But all the things that we normally think of as Druidic, when we think about Druidic, comes out of these stories.
You know how when
these guys have
been reading too much
television.
It seems like there's some kind of way of othering this culture.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, completely.
Well, this is what happens with Traveller's Tales, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you bring back Traveller's Tales and their currency is the fact that they're exotic and other and mysterious.
Yeah.
And, you know, why do you love them? Yeah.
Now, what happens in particular? So, how do these vague sort of stories end up in creating this very solid idea of Druids creating authentic spiritual organisations like Obod? You know, and so how do we get from there to here in that sense? Well, partly it's something that happens really around the 18th century, which has a lot to do, if we think about the dynamics of the 18th century, this is industrialization, this is the time when the great split is happening between the city and the countryside. Now, tomorrow I'm going to go into more of the genuine traditions that we can call on. But one of the things that we have to look at in clearing this away is looking at how does the fantasy, in a certain sense, of what has been get created. Now, one of the things that's happening in the 18th century is the power of industrialization, also the power of the great European empires are now starting to ramp up. They're starting to get to the place where in the 19th century they'll end up dominating the world. So the Industrial Revolution is starting to kick in. Blake is starting to warn us about the dark satanic mills. We're getting this great split starting to develop in human society between the people who live in the cities and that's always been there, but this is now because of the need to depopulate the countryside to serve the new factories and the mines that are developing that are going to be the energies that drive the Industrial Revolution. We're now starting to see a fissure happening in human society. Now, as a counter reaction to that, there's a sort of romantic reaction to that, which people like the poets Wordsworth and Coleridge and are part of the vanguard, William Blake himself, of course, primarily challenging much of that. But as part of that, and certainly in Wales, part of what you start to see is a romantic interest, really, in the traditions of Wales, and therefore there's a whole process of looking at the old Welsh traditions and into the mix in particular comes the remarkable and difficult figure of Iolo Mac Annog, Iolo of Glamorgan. Now, Iolo creates a book called the Bravadas, means the bards, teachings of the bards, in which Iolo creates a whole cosmology, practice, structure, description of bardic organization. He creates bardic triads, produces ancient manuscripts he's discovered, but actually has invented. He is right at the heart of the great renaissance of Welsh tradition. Now, one of the complicated bloody things about Iolo is that he did have access to old traditions, old medieval traditions, and we'll never know, because he destroyed sources, because he's producing, like any good forger, you create the forged document and you get rid of anything that proves that he's nicked that from somewhere else. So what starts to happen is the production in Wales of a whole set of manuscripts and teachings in both Welsh and English that start to describe this world of Druidry. Now, it's seen through the world of the 18th century Enlightenment, so it's a form of in the same way that Caesar is looking at the Druids as if they are Greek philosophers. What we see in the 18th century writings is the Druids seen as ideal Christians, primitive, in fact they even get called primitive Christians before Christianity. They worship the sun, they worship the one God who is seen as the sun god, but who represents everything. Drawing on Pliny, and they're dressed in white, they have all the mistletoe, all of that, these are all the things. So these old Roman stories get reinterpreted and recreated as a description of this is the ancient Welsh religion. It's mingled with Christianity, because Christianity, of course, is the dominant religion, and so we get strange things like the Heliarchite idea, which is a connection between the Noah's Ark and Arthur, and so there's all kinds of strange things that come off this. But but as part of that, the whole idea of the Druids as being the builders. So the Druids are the builders of the stone circles. Which is why whenever there is a nationalised Steddfod in town, they put up a stone circle. And there's lots of stone circles all over Wales, wherever a nice Steddfod has been. And that comes directly out of Iolo Mac Annog. I mean, everybody knows now that, of course, it wasn't real, but such it is now with its own tradition. So where the Esteved appears, wham, there's a stone circle. Now, the problem with all of that is that in some ways that it creates a mask over what are the real kind of teachings, the real things that have survived. And where you have to go, really, if you're going to look at what has survived of British tradition, is you have to come to the medieval texts. So, as I say, the first person that we come to is Geoffrey of Monmouth.
When was that?
12th century. 900 years ago, not thousands of years ago. Mabinogion, 100 years later, 100 to 200 years later. Black Book of Carmarthen, 100 years later than Geoffrey. So one of the things that we do have to sweep away is the idea that that there's been some coherent, secret tradition passed down through family lines that preserves the ancient teachings of the Druids. We have no idea what the Druids taught. We have various from the other place that people look for. Some of the remains, in particular Lindo Man's a good so there's just outside Alderley Edge there's a Lindo Common, a peat bog figure was found of somebody called Lindo Man, who's now in the British Museum, who appears to have undergone a ritual death, and there were evidence that he was strangled, struck on the back of the head, and had his throat cut. And in his body was found bannock cakes that were burned black and mistletoe seeds. And Anne Ross, who is a great writer of Celtic themes, wrote a book about Lindo Man where she regarded Lindo Man as a sort of a druidic figure who was a sacrificial figure who was being sacrificed to... buy off, really, or mitigate the effect of the Roman invasions. Now, intuitively, if we look at Lindo Man and work with the image of Lindo Man, there's something interesting, we can find some interesting things. But the problem is, when we try to literalize these things, they don't work. What we're looking at, the reality is, the great and wonderful reality that this thing, all this stuff obscures, is that there is a living, poetic, imaginal tradition that speaks back to us, just as Phil's mound spoke back to us. Okay, oral tradition in action, right? Phil describes his experience to us. Brings that particular mound into the room. We sit with it together. We contemplate it together. It embodies between us. Now, it's not a literal... He's the only person who's ever seen that mound. But it starts to touch us, starts to affect us, starts to connect us with this wider tradition that speaks back to us. We have to handle it in a careful way. We have to not make the mistakes that some of the Roman writers have. So we have to look at whole things in the unproven category, the great category of Scottish law, right? Proven, disproven, unproven. We hold things sometimes in the unproven category until they become tangible or not. the meditation we did just before this talk is based upon the Roll Right ritual that was created by Marcus's godfather Bill Gray, and that is in itself a powerful example of the recovery of tradition. Bill, I mean, I really recommend, if you're interested in it, really recommend getting hold of a copy of it. It's an intense, very concentrated piece of work. But it comes about by the extraordinary Bill Gray, who, with an old bone shaker or bicycle, used to cycle. How many miles is it from Cheltenham?
40 miles.
Used to cycle 40 miles from Cheltenham up to the road, and it's uphill, right? It's not downhill. 40 miles uphill. And to get there before dawn, to hang out with the complex of the Roll Right stones, which has a very complete kind of little monument that holds within it a lot of the patterns that we're looking at. And certainly the meditation we did around this, in terms of just tapping into this old territory, revisit that meditation. There are whole layers of experience within that can be deepened into. And what Bill showed us and then left for us as a method for us then to work with is the way to work with this material. Don't fantasize about it, don't speculate about it, engage with it, listen to it, test it out, work with it in your own experience, and then when you have that refined enough, share that with other people, see what they can do with it. Unfortunately, there is a lot of material, both in terms of ancient sites and of texts, that we're going to be exploring, that while they're much later on, as I say, the 12th, 13th, 14th century, 15th century, some places, you know, that can be worked with, that bring us into a direct relationship with this sense of ancestral tradition.
Except the point that a lot of this written text, linguistically, parts of it can be linked back to a much older oral tradition, and so it actually takes us a couple of centuries further back than the actual writing. I think particularly of Colliff and Olwen. But I mean that's because of the structure. I don't know enough about the linguistics to go further with that, but I know.
I mean, if we look at things like, we'll talk in more detail on this when we look at the texts themselves. But I think that there's, yes and no. You see, this is a complicated thing. Yes, there is definitely evidence of within the Colliff and Olwen and some of the other stories of that older oral tradition. But. By the time the Mabinogi is written and developed, we've got the Arthurian literature as well massively underway. Mm. So much of the material comes across from France and back and forth. So there's a whole lot of cultural diffusion and movement between traditions. Mm. So I would say it certainly does feel to me like the stories of the Mabinogi and the Four Branches and the Arthurian stories have within them much older traditions. But you see, we can't know that. That's the complicated thing, right? Everybody wants to know that, and we all want to attribute all kinds of things to this. But in some ways we have to treat the material on its own terms. How does the material speak to us? Mm. Now, one of the most interesting bits of material, which we're going to look at tomorrow, really, is Geoffrey of Monmouth. Partly, you see, one of the helpful things about Geoffrey of Monmouth is that we know who wrote it. We know it's Geoffrey. A bit like Caesar, we know his biases. So partly with Geoffrey, we know he's flat. It was funny, really. I always think of Geoffrey Archer when I think of Geoffrey of Monmouth. Well, because they're both popular bestsellers, right? Yes, and there's a sort of Geoffrey had his eye on the main chance. You know, he was a clerk in holy orders, but he needed to please his patrons, and he's writing flattering things. He's writing things for the Norman overlords. And it's, you know, and the 12th century, the Norman overlords, and the Welsh are not their major problem, it's the Saxons that are their problems. And so writing them to say how awful the Saxons are, and how kind of, you know, the great, and when he says in particular in the Prophecy of Merlin that the those out of Nestria, the riders in armoured coats. Now this is the classic Norman horse cavalry, are the ones that come to restore order and restore the ancient inhabitants. Well, of course, he is massively pleasing the overlords who want to be told this is, you know, all conquerors want to feel they're doing a good thing, right? But nobody wants to be the villain, even though the villains never want to be villains. So you always tell a conqueror, well, you're helping out, really. You're actually restoring the ancient order. You're making things good again. Good on you.
Where do the triads fit in? As in, like, you know, like the Rachel Bromwich collection of triads. Because it's interesting you say about how we engage with it, because I find them very engaging in terms of...
Well, they're great, the triads.
Like, because you don't know who these people... You get a sense of what we've lost, and you get a sense of ancientness, which can't be proven, I'm sure, but there is something quite... very engaging about them, because they're so mysterious, aren't they?
No, they are, and I think that's what it's in Penny's point, really. The triads have this very, very ancient kind of form, and this sense of your... And one of the things that's interesting, I think, is when you... if you look at the accounts of modern, if you look at Irish storytellers, Scottish storytellers, you can see that the mnemonics that are used, I mean, the triads are storytellers' mnemonics. So that, you know, so that, and some of them, you know, some of them we have no reference for poor, but if I think there's one triad that always lives with me, so it goes like this. Three things cause the destruction of Logres: the receiving of strangers, the freeing of prisoners, and the gift of the bald man. Now, receiving of strangers, hospitality is one of the great virtues of Celtic culture, of Welsh culture. Well, but and the right at the heart of Welsh tradition, the freeing of the prisoner who is Mabon, the son of Modron, is one of the great achievements. The gift of the bald, and the only bald man we know about is Tegid the Bald, who is the sort of husband of Ceridwen. So we're shown one of the great, you know, great figures of feminine creative power in Welsh tradition. So we're here given a triad that is about the destruction of the world, that seems to be related to the great virtues and the central things of Welsh tradition. It holds a paradox inside it. And there's things like, you know, three red ravagers, Medrawd at Camlan, Abagdhi at Penyvoeth, when Arthur was the worst, and Arthur is the worst ravager of all. Well, you know, so there are these, you know, they're tapping into, and in fact, they're really, again, powerful intuitive contemplation points for us to recover some of these, an aspect of these ancient traditions, in part because we don't know them in a way. The person who is the great, of course, the writer who is the great kind of reviver of tradition in our time is Alan Garner. Now, what we see Alan Garner doing is really working with the local traditions of Alderley Edge and really sinking a deep well, really, and working with layer upon layer upon layer, and doing that really in the service of the renewal of his part of the world soul. And in a certain sense, what these stories do offer us a key, a way into these ancient kind of traditions. Let me just check them. So